When people think of Visa, they think of credit cards, but Visa is so much more than just a credit card company. It's a technology and innovation company that's making digital payments a reality for consumers, businesses, banks, and governments all around the world. At Visa, they have a simple and unwavering vision that can be traced back to their beginnings in 1958 to be the best way to pay and be paid for everyone, everywhere. They know that every Visa transaction is a promise. Whether you're at a food truck outside the stadium or paying your fancy league dues online, Visa wants to provide you with the most secure and easy payment experience possible. All you have to figure out is, where would you like to be? Visa, everywhere you want to be.
Hi everyone, good morning and welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is Nick Wright. This right here is Brian Westbrook.
What up, B?
Good morning.
Good to see
Great
you, brother.
Great to see you
Excited
guys.
For today's show.
What a fantastic day in sports to talk about yesterday. So much to get to in the NFL as far as head coaches are concerned. We will tackle all of that in just a second. But we got to start this morning's show with the big story out of the NBA last night. So Knicks and Lakers played. That wasn't the story. This was the scary moment for Anthony Davis. Comes down hard in the third quarter trying to block Julius Randle's shot. AD stayed on the floor for several minutes in pain after the fall before being helped up and to the locker room. He would not return. X-rays were negative. Turns out he's got a bruised tailbone, but he is expected to miss the upcoming two-game road trip. Lakers do get the 30-point win. All right, Nick, when you look at something like this, is this the kind of thing to an injury to either Anthony Davis or maybe LeBron James? Is that the only thing that could possibly derail the Lakers at this point?
There's no team in the league that can deal with a major injury that knocks a player out for the postseason for one of their top two guys. None of the contenders. The Rockets can't deal without Harden or Westbrook, even though Russ isn't playing that well. The Bucks, as amazing as Giannis is, if Middleton goes down, they're done as championship contenders. The Clippers obviously need Kawhi and Paul George. So yeah, the Lakers are the best team in the NBA. The Lakers are clearly the best team in the Western Conference. Some people might push back and say Milwaukee's the best team in the NBA. And the Lakers are the favorites to represent the Western Conference in the NBA Finals. If they don't have that guy or LeBron, if they don't have 3 or 23, then that story changes immediately. Fortunately for the Lakers, this is a badly bruised tailbone. He's going to miss a couple games, and given their schedule after the two-game road trip that they've essentially already said he's going to miss at Dallas and at OKC, they're home for Cleveland and Orlando. So if you want to, you give Anthony Davis a full week, a little more than a week off, and probably be fine, which is one of the reasons, Brian, it was so incumbent upon the Lakers to get off to the fast start they did. They've only had one bad week of basketball all year when they lost those four games. They've only lost seven games all season. They're 4.5 up on the rest of the conference, and we are almost at the midway point. So even if in a stretch where they could have gone 4-0, they go 3-1 because they lose one of these two road games without Anthony Davis, they still have a cushion that's going to be very important at the end of the year when the Lakers actually do rest their players as opposed to during the year the way some teams are doing. But yeah, I mean, I see no major weaknesses with this basketball team, aside from they need to moderate Rajon Rondo's minutes and give Alex Caruso more of those minutes. Maybe they trade Kyle Kuzma, but if Anthony Davis and LeBron are there, they are the best team in the Western Conference and arguably the best team in the whole league.
You're right. If Anthony Davis and LeBron are there, they are the best team probably in the NBA, but if either one of those guys is missing, that burden falls to the other guy so quickly. And of course, any team without one of their stars is going to be trailing. But here's the thing, and this is what Anthony Davis means to this basketball team. A great defender. Yep. He protects the rim. And this basketball team is second in the league in fast break points. And so they're out and running because of those rebounds, because of the rim protection that Anthony Davis provides you there. And listen, LeBron plays much better defense this year than he had in the last couple years, but that's still not what LeBron's there for. He's there to distribute, to get things going, to score points as well. Anthony Davis is a catalyst for this basketball team. Of course they need him and LeBron to get going. The other part to this is that, and you mentioned it too, they went out hard this season. They wanted to get home court advantage. Yep. They wanted to get those big leads and to be able to rest their guys towards the end of the season. This kind of hurts that a little bit. And now LeBron has to go harder. How does this impact LeBron as the season goes on, especially if it's more than a couple games that Anthony Davis will be out?
So that's the question. But luckily, they're through the tough part of that stretch that they started off this season. There's an easy part to start. They had the tough December. It gets a little bit easier for them now. So if someone is going to go down, take a couple games off, this would be that stretch. But the question then becomes, like, how much can LeBron do by himself, or how much can AD do by themselves? How much do they need each other for this Lakers thing to work?
Well, thus far this season, Anthony Davis, when LeBron hasn't been on the court, the Lakers have been a bad team. When it's just they have not figured out an offense, and I don't think that's a reflection on Anthony Davis. I think it's a reflection on the Lakers do not have a playmaker they trust other than LeBron. So LeBron, when he and AD are on the court together, they outscore the opposition by 12.5 points. When LeBron is on the court without Anthony Davis, they outscore the opposition by 12 points, almost the same. When Anthony Davis is on the court without LeBron, the Lakers actually get outscored. So if you're going to miss one of them for a week or so, right now, this moment, Anthony Davis would obviously be the option because they actually have depth in the front court. One of the reasons they're being outscored when LeBron goes to the bench is because Rondo's coming in. Rondo's been really bad, and they need to give those minutes to Caruso, but the other key part is what you alluded to, which is getting out to the early start. We went into this year thinking there were five excellent teams in the Western Conference. The Lakers, the Rockets, the Clippers, the Nuggets, the Jazz. The Mavericks have elevated themselves into that group, so there are six. The Thunder, meanwhile, with Chris Paul, are a frisky seven seed. But that is where the conference ends. The eight seed right now is 14-20. I say that to say this. The one seed is so immensely valuable, not just because of home court advantage, because it's a de facto first round bye. My concern for the Clippers throughout the year, going into the year, was they were going to load manage their way into a brutal first round matchup. And you look at the standings today and it's like, oh, the Clippers are the four seed. They would be playing Utah in the first round. Meanwhile, the Lakers would be playing the San Antonio Spurs. And so if the Lakers, if they, without Anthony Davis, lose three in a row, all of a sudden their lead evaporates. All of a sudden, all the work they did in the beginning of the season is almost for naught. I don't think that's going to happen, but the one seed is intensely valuable in the Western Conference this year, because while the Nuggets are going to be fighting with, just to pick teams, the Thunder, and the Rockets got to deal with Dallas, and the Lakers and the Clippers and Jazz are going against each other, the Lakers would be coasting above the fray against Sacramento or Memphis or San Antonio or Portland, whoever finds that eight seed, probably have an extra week of rest after sweeping that series. That's what you got to watch for in these next few games. Do the Lakers drop a game they shouldn't, two games they shouldn't, three games they shouldn't without Anthony Davis, and all of a sudden they are back in the muck with the rest of the Western Conference instead of clear of the field?
You're right. They certainly want to be able to coast through that first round of the playoffs. They want to be able to get their players some rest. When you watch this team with Anthony Davis on the floor, he is such a matchup nightmare. I mean, you can find ways to get the ball out of LeBron's hand. You throw a double team at him. You run at him every time he touches it. But Anthony Davis, no matter what position he's playing, the four, the five, the three, sometimes getting the ball on the wing, he has the ability just to move around in spaces and be a matchup nightmare. And without that, again, LeBron's going to have to work so much harder. That puts him in a bad position in year 16 at 35 years old to finish the season healthy. That's the most important thing for this team. How do you finish the season? How healthy are you going into the playoffs, if this lasts longer than a week? I remember when I was 15 years old, I remember the day that I bruised my tailbone. I was skating, tried to turn around, go backwards, fell on my tailbone. I remember that day. That's how long that thing stuck with me, because I was out for more than 2 weeks of playing football and basketball at the time. Anthony Davis, hopefully he comes back healthy in a quick time, but if this thing lingers, this is going to hurt their opportunity, especially in the first round of the playoffs.
And if you watch the game last night, I know LeBron had 31. If you look at the box score, he got, what is that, 25 of those points on threes and free throws. He's still dealing with that groin injury a bit. He doesn't have quite the burst. So we'll see without Anthony Davis, with LeBron. He was under the weather a bit yesterday, and you can tell from watching, he's still dealing with a bit of a groin injury, how much of that load he can take on when they play the Mavs, a Mavs team that's played him in two excellent games already this year.
Right, despite all of that, a 30-point win over the Knicks. Olympics, which is great. Roller skating or inline skating?
Roller skating.
That's adorable.
That's what we used to do back in the day.
You go to the roller rink.
That's right.
Parents drop you off.
You dribble. That's why you meet all the girls at the roller skating rink.
On to the NFL now. The Giants are reportedly set to hire Patriots special teams coordinator and wide receivers coach Joe Judge as their next head coach. That despite the state of the Patriots wide receivers this past year. In a word, bad. The 38-year-old Judge was mentored by both Nick Saban and Bill Belichick. Giants also reportedly want to interview Jason Garrett to fill their offensive coordinator slot. Brian, I'll start with you. What do you think of the moves the Giants made yesterday?
You know, I was surprised. I was surprised because you're going to the situation where you had Bob McAdoo for a couple of years. You had Pat Shurmur for a couple of years, both kind of flamed out and failed. And now you're getting a guy that's really unknown. No one knew who the heck Joe Judge was really before yesterday, the day before. And so you got him, you put him in a situation where you're saying, you have a young quarterback. How do you mentor that quarterback? Who are your coordinators going to be? These are big time questions for Joe Judge. But I also see the other side. I spent time with John Harbaugh before he became the head coach, before he came the secondary coach. And when he was the special teams coach, when I was playing majority special teams, I saw his situation awareness. I saw his attention to detail. I saw his ability to motivate the players, how to get the guys together. Because in the NFL, nobody really wants to play special teams. You want to play offense or defense. You want to make your name on those types of things. And so they have to be able to, the special teams coordinators have to be able to bring the guys together to motivate them, to get them ready to play. John Harbaugh was able to do that. And so I guess the Giants are saying Joe Judge probably has that same skill because the special teams for the Patriots has won them a few games this past season. They played well in the past as well. And so they have to be looking at that. Here's the big difference between the situation that John Harbaugh walks into and the situation that Joe Judge walks into. Doesn't have Ed Reed, doesn't have Ray Lewis, two Hall of Famers, doesn't have Terrell Suggs, potentially a Hall of Famer. Most importantly, he doesn't have Ozzie Newsome, who is the best GM in football at this point in time. And so these are the questions that they're going to have to answer after they hire Joe Judge. Big time questions in New York.
To me, there's two discussions about this. One is about the person, Joe Judge. I don't know Joe Judge. I'm very happy for him. From all reports, he's worked incredibly hard. He has learned under Nick Saban and Bill Belichick, and the Patriots unit, to me, that was the most standout, impressive, head and shoulders better than everyone else in the league, aside from their kicking part of it, was their special teams last year. They were the best punt blocking team I can ever remember. Jerry Jones had a damn near meltdown after that game because Joe Judge's special teams units gave Jason Garrett's special teams units such fits in that game. And I do think, as a general rule, special teams coordinators should get more opportunities because what I have heard from people who played for John Harbaugh talk about how he was able to take a holistic approach to the team, not focus on one side of the ball, and how that helped them. So I don't think this is necessarily a bad hire. It's a risky hire. The Giants are putting themselves in a position where somehow they could be on another new head coach in a couple years, so maybe it's not the hire I would have made. But Joe Judge, good for him. I'm happy for him. The other conversation is, it is so frustrating that people that look like Joe Judge are the only people that get to take this career path. That we are in a league that is over 60% black and less than 10% of the coaches are black. And he became Joe Judge because it's like, wait, who? He became the poster boy for this. This is not his fault. And by the way, the Giants are allowed to hire on an individual basis whomever they want. This is not the Giants' fault. It is just another reminder that there's a systemic problem in this league when it comes to giving non-white guys opportunities to be head coaches. And we can go down the list. Yeah, of course, Eric Bieniemy should be a top candidate. Doug Peterson was Andy Reid's right-hand man. He got a job. Matt Nagy was his right-hand man. He got a job. Eric Bieniemy is his right-hand man for the best offense Andy Reid's ever had. And all of a sudden, it's a problem. Well, Andy calls the plays. What no problem for Peterson. Yep. What no problem for Nagy. Byron Leftwich. He takes Jameis Winston. Had more passing yards this year than any quarterback in the history of football not named Peyton, Breeze, Brady, or Roethlisberger. He's not even considered. Leslie Frazier took a team with Christian Ponder as the quarterback to the postseason. He's been relegated to be a coordinator for a damn near a decade since one bad year after that. And for folks that want to say, well, you want them to just hire a token candidate, or you don't want them to hire the best person for the job. Again, this is not about Joe Judge. He might have been the best person. But the assumption that you could have the demographics of the league and end with the demographics of the coaching staffs and have that only be a meritocracy is so, to me, wildly ignorant. What would we think if all of a sudden 30% of NHL coaches were black? We'd be like, well, that is peculiar, considering the fact that the vast majority of players are not. And this is not just an NFL problem. It's an NBA problem. It is an American corporate issue of black people and non-white people not getting opportunities of leadership. And it ultimately comes from the inherent assumption, whether people want to admit it or not, that many people have, which is, I can trust you to play for me. I can trust you on the defensive side of the ball to motivate guys. I can trust you to be an emotional part, a leader. But when it comes to the thinking man spots, I don't know. I'd rather take a chance on this kid, or I'd rather take a chance on this college coach than turn the reins over to a black person. And it's incredibly frustrating. And I think the league has done a lot to try to fix it, but you need the actual owners to be invested in fixing it. Brian, in the last 20 years, over 25% of the black head coaches we've had in this league, and there's only been 18 of them, have come from Tony Dungy's tree. Mm-hmm. If not for Tony Dungy, there'd be almost none. That is a systemic issue, and I do feel bad that Joe Judge became the face of it because he doesn't deserve to be. But I'd be lying if I didn't admit that's what I thought of when I saw Joe Judge, 38-year-old special teams coordinator, got the job, and not any of the other qualified candidates.
The question has to be asked, why aren't these candidates getting a realistic look? Some of these guys are getting brought in. Eric Bieniemy has been brought in. Byron Leftwich, over the next couple of years, will continue to get brought in. I think Leslie Frazier, listen, he's taken a very good defense and continues to get better. Why aren't they getting a serious look? That's the question. The Rooney Rule is put in place for a reason, and I think some of these teams have kind of skirted it just a bit. But the real question is, why aren't these guys getting the look? And I think you hit the nail on the head. We're good enough to play. However, the point to being able to lead the other 65, 70% of black men in the locker room, for some teams, they've said, you know what, you're not good enough to do it. I would look directly at Mike Tomlin and say, what has he been to that football team? Because this year, let's just talk about this year. He's taking backup quarterback after backup quarterback and said, we still have a chance of making the playoffs. He knows how to lead men. There's other black coaches, opportunities out there, and that these guys have the ability to lead black men as well. They should be taken seriously.
Look, maybe Joe Judge is that diamond in the rough. Maybe he's the one guy that you're going to pluck and he turns out to be the John Harbaugh, if you will. More likely, he was brought in and interviewed and perhaps hired because of his relationship with Bill Belichick and all the great things that have sprung from Bill Belichick. But the Patriots had a terrible wide receiving core last year. And show me where the Bill Belichick tree, besides maybe Vrabel, who is a player, has sprung successful head coaches. I don't see it.
Well, it's a really fair point, Jenna. And I'm glad you mentioned the part about Vrabel, because Vrabel's being lumped into the tree by others.
And he was a player.
He never coached for him.
No.
Vrabel was traded to the Chiefs, coached at Ohio State, and then coached under Bill O'Brien, who some would argue has been the most successful of the Belichick disciples. I would argue our friend Eric Mangini, his record might not show it, but given the teams he coached, I think he could have been an excellent long-term coach in this league. But Charlie Weiss obviously flamed out at multiple levels. Romeo Crennel is not a head coach in this league. I don't feel Matt Patricia is a head coach in this league, but they, of course, fired Jim Caldwell because 9 wins wasn't good enough in 1 year, but 9 wins is plenty good for Vrabel to keep his job in 2 years, which gets back to the other conversation. But people, listen, they ran out of Sean McVay friends to hire, so now it became Bill Belichick coaches. Like, there's been a great way to become a head coach in this league. One way was be Ray Lewis's defensive coordinator. All of those guys got to do it. Yep. And the other was be Tom Brady adjacent. And all of a sudden, and they ran, McDaniels took interviews, Joe Judge got the job, the coordinator, defensive coordinator in back-to-back years in Patriots has gotten the job. And I think Flores might end up being a good coach. I thought Flores did a really good job given his limited weapons, but That is the question. Can you bring what you've learned from New England and install that system elsewhere? And will the team, Brian, give you time to install that system elsewhere?
The time, that's the real point, because there have been opportunities for African-American coordinators to get jobs as coaches. They don't get the same amount of time and opportunity to stay in that job when they have down seasons or seasons that are just not even good. I mean, well, here's the thing. When you talked about Leslie Frazier, you talk about Caldwell as well. They don't get the opportunity to say, you know what, we had an 8-8 year or a 9-7 year. Their expectation has to be 12-4, 11-5 for them to be able to stay in that job. That just isn't fair.
Jim Caldwell went 14-2 into a Super Bowl, then won 10 games, then won 2 games the year Peyton got hurt, got fired, yep. Goes to Detroit. Detroit wins 11-7, 9-9, 2 playoff appearances. The organization had won in the previous 14 years before he got there. Out, gone, not good enough, and probably will never get another head coaching job again. That's the issue we're talking about here. Again, I really feel badly that we're talking about it with Joe Judge sitting over my shoulder, because it ain't his fault, and I wish him the best of luck, but it was glaringly obvious when this hire was made.
The Cowboys have finally made it official. Mike McCarthy named their new head coach. Dallas will hold a press conference later today, and then Mike McCarthy gets to go to work. We're hearing reports that Jim Tomsula will be their defensive coordinator. John Fossil from the Rams will come over and reportedly be their special teams head coach. And Kellen Moore will stay on as offensive coordinator. Nick, I'll start with you. What do you make of the Cowboys bringing Kellen Moore back?
Well, I think it's important, like you mentioned the staff. Mike Nolan, the defensive coordinator. Jim Tomsula, defensive line coach, it would look like. And so you have all this experience on the staff along with Mike McCarthy. And then Kellen Moore, who's very inexperienced, obviously, but last year had his best, Dak had his best year under him. Here's the other part of it that I potentially like. I think Mike McCarthy is still going to call plays, but I'm not certain about that. Because if Kellen Moore is retained, and it looks like he would have had other options, is there some type of agreement on I'm going to be at least heavily involved in the play calling? I prefer my head coach not call plays. There's too much going on during the game. And I understand the head coach of my actual team, Andy Reid, does call plays.
Right?
But what's Andy Reid's biggest weakness?
Time
management, clock management, timeouts, the things that you should be focused on during the game that is tough to focus on if you're also figuring out the next play to call. Who are the best coaches in football? Bill Belichick, does he call offensive plays? John Harbaugh, Mike Tomlin, Pete Carroll, all those guys have something in common. Shanahan is an excellent play caller. You don't want to take that away from him. He's not great at the game management stuff. I would argue Sean McVay's not great at the game management stuff. I just mentioned Andy Reid. So can Kellen Moore take some of this off of Mike McCarthy's plate? I also do wonder if during the sleepover Mike McCarthy had with Jerry Jones, this was a prerequisite. It was, listen, you can make your entire staff, except I would really, really appreciate if you keep Kellen. Jerry Jones has a history of wanting guys who played for him to be involved in the coaching operation in some way, shape, or form. Obviously, they bring in Kitna last year. Kellen Moore gets elevated to offensive coordinator. So I think this was probably an ask from Jerry Jones that Mike McCarthy acquiesced to, because what you see from the rest of his staff, it's like, oh, so he wants longtime NFL head coach, NFL guys with coaching experience. John Fossil, a coach's son who did a great job with special teams in Los Angeles. Mike Nolan, who'd been a head coach before, been around another coach's son, by the way, been around the league forever. And Tomsula, who'd been a head coach in San Francisco and been around the league forever. And then there's 31-year-old Kellen Moore. One of these things is not like the other. I feel like this was an ownership ask that Mike McCarthy agreed to.
It may have been an ownership ask, and I think the sleepover probably kind of disrupted me just a little bit, because I'm saying, hey, Jerry Jones is already controlling Mike McCarthy. He's making him stay at his house already.
Yeah, man, but there's got to be a Four Seasons up the street, man. I'll see you in the morning for coffee.
That's an uncomfortable thing for any grown man to stay at another man's house. But anyway, I think this. if you're Kellen Moore and you just got the best season of his career out of Dak Prescott, I think you deserve an opportunity there. I think you deserve an opportunity to be on the staff, to continue that relationship with Dak. And I think Mike McCarthy probably should want Kellen Moore on that staff, because just for those reasons you mentioned, it's going to take some pressure off of Mike McCarthy to call plays. And listen, he may not call play all season long, but in a critical situation, Kellen Moore may be called upon to call plays. Or really, even if there's a situation that Mike McCarthy's dealing with something on the defensive side of the ball, Kellen Moore may be called upon to call plays, and he has confidence that he has a competent guy that was able to do it the year before with Dak Prescott that has that ability. Who has a better idea of what's on that football team right now than Kellen Moore, the guy that called plays? And so I think this is a smart hire for Mike McCarthy. I think it's a great hire for the Dallas Cowboys, and really for Dak Prescott, who's going to get a lot of coaching from Mike McCarthy. I think this is a good hire, because now you can kind of balance that out with Kellen Moore.
And the issue with Dallas last year was not their ability to accumulate yards or accumulate points. They averaged more than 25 points a game. They averaged more than 400 yards of offense a game. Teams like that always make the playoffs historically, unless you have a horrific defense, which Dallas did not. The issue was the inability to beat good teams, situational play calling, which, by the way, is something McCarthy had struggled with as well. So those two guys need to put their brains together and figure that out. And in the key spots, who are we giving the ball to? And so that is something Kellen Moore can learn from, and I would imagine Mike McCarthy can learn from as well.
Not to be lost in all the coaching hires, actual playoff games this weekend. Let's start in the AFC. Titans and Ravens. Yes, Lamar Jackson put together an MVP caliber season, but also, yes, he says his sights are set higher, as in the Super Bowl. Titans head coach Mike Vrabel called Lamar the best player in the league who is impossible to tackle. Brian, will Lamar be able to dominate the playoffs like he dominated the regular season?
Jenna, I watched all of his runs. I watched all of his games in the last couple weeks, and there was no team. And I thought San Francisco was going to be the team that had the best matchup, the best opportunity to take advantage of Lamar, hit him when he's doing the read option, when he's running the football, be able to contact the quarterback, make it hard upon him. And there was no team throughout the 16 games, he only played 15 of the season, that were able to hit and put Lamar in a bad situation continuously throughout the game. It was the ball handling. It was the really pick your poison. Do you want the run game or the physical dominant run game with Mark Ingram to run the ball down your throat? Or do you want to allow Lamar to get on the edge at that point and run the football? And if you put Lamar on the edge, there's nobody on the defensive side that's fast enough, that has the ability to break down and make a tackle on Lamar Jackson. In the NFL, we've seen it all season long, he's dominated. Here's the other thing. In the week's time that these teams have to prepare for the Baltimore Ravens, it's just hard to get up to speed to figure out what they're doing with the ball handling, because there's just not very many teams in the league that are doing this. And so you kind of see it in college football where the big schools are playing Army and Navy, and they're running the triple option. No one understands what's going on with those plays. Same type of thing for the Baltimore Ravens. Here's the other part. You have to pick your poison on different levels. You pick your poison in the run game with Lamar as well as Mark Ingram. Then in the secondary, you have to say, are we going to try to stop Mark Andrews and Hayden Hurst, or are we going to take the deep pass away with Hollywood Brown? And so there are so many different things that defenses have to be aware of. It cuts into their practice time. And if a team is practicing and thinking about so many different things, it's hard to be able to focus on just the quarterback.
I agree with a lot of what you said, but to answer the question directly, do I expect him to dominate in the playoffs just like he did in the regular season? Absolutely not. I think he's going to be really good. Ravens might win the Super Bowl. But if you look at Lamar's stats overall for the year, they tell one story. If you look at the game-by-game numbers, they tell another. Bad teams were drawing absolutely dead against this offense, and he threw the ball like he was the best passing quarterback in football. The inability for bad teams, instead of picking your poison, they took both. They're like, I don't know which, it's kill me. And so, but against good defenses, the way the Ravens beat you was running the football. They, against Buffalo, he threw for 145 yards. They won by a touchdown. Against San Francisco, he threw for 105 yards. They won by 3 points in a game that came down to a couple fourth down conversions for each team at the very, very end. If you are playing, if you're the Titans, you have to simply go into the game, I feel, and say, if he's electric throwing the ball down the field, if he's electric throwing the ball outside the hashes, we lose. We are going to give you that. And if you beat us that way by throwing for 275, then we can't beat you. Because if you try to have it both ways, which is what you're talking about, it's like kind of take away Mark Ingram, kind of take away the edges, kind of take away the outside. You take away nothing, and they are too dynamic. And so I would simply say, I want Lamar to further prove he can pass deep down the field and outside the numbers, which is great as he was this year. He should be the unanimous league MVP. He was not, against good teams, very good at that. And the one other question I would have is, with any young player who has minimal playoff experience, and the playoff experience they do have is awful, how much does that affect him? He has said all year, Jenna, you're right. I'm not focused on the MVP. I'm not focused on breaking Mike Vick's record here. I'm not focused on my 99 speed rating. I'm focused on winning the Super Bowl. This is the first game he's played all year that can derail him. This is the first game all year where if I don't play well, that my one lone goal is over. I do wonder for any young player in this league how that affects them when their previous experience was awful. They're down 23-3 or 24-3 with 6 minutes left in that game, and the fans are chanting for Joe Flacco. And so, I think Lamar is sensational, but I don't think he's going to be the MVP of the playoffs. They might win the Super Bowl, but I think he is going to be at least a slightly different player in the postseason than we saw in the regular season, because there are no Miamis and Arizonas to beat up on, and I think teams are going to make him throw the football.
The good thing for Lamar is that their defense is much better this year than it was last year. 3 games with 5 touchdowns, 4 games with 3 passing touchdowns as well. Hey, listen, if you pick your poison and want to say he has to throw the ball down the field, he has the ability to beat you. He's gotten much better at the passing part of the game.
Still, it's all tasks for Tennessee, no matter what, whatever they decide. We talk about physical fitness a lot, but there's another side to the game that's just as important. I'm talking about mental fitness. Calm, the number one app for sleep and meditation, has now teamed up with LeBron James to help you train your mind. LeBron and Calm know that your mind is like any other muscle in your body, and Calm can help you train your brain so you sleep better, so you have less stress, so you perform at your best. For LeBron James, sleep is an important part of his mental fitness routine. He says, getting good sleep and finding time to rest is one of the most valuable things I can do for my body and mind. And if you head to calm.com/sports40, you'll get 40% off a Calm premium membership. With Calm, you have access to the nature scenes LeBron loves and so much more, like sleep stories and meditations. For a limited time, our listeners can join LeBron in using Calm with a 40% discount to an annual membership at calm.com/sports40. Unlock content to help you focus, ease stress, and sleep better. Get started at calm.com/sports40. That's calm.com/sports40. Back here, first things first, now joined by 3-time Pro Bowl quarterback Carson Palmer. Good morning,
Carson.
Friend
of the show. Morning. Good to see you,
Carson.
Good
morning.
It's so great for our audience at home when two former players get together, because you think they're going to be like, oh, what even up to? No, it's how much pain were you in your life? So it was hard for you, right, to get up in the morning? Right. I mean, that's what the whole commercial break was. But
that's
we
right.
give you credit for your grit and being out here. So thanks so much, guys. All right, let's talk sports, because that's what Nick and I do really well. The Patriots' 20-year run of dominance might be coming to a close. 42-year-old Tom Brady's future is up in the air. Bill Belichick is watching the rest of the playoffs from home. And Robert Kraft has some decisions to make, which had us wondering who deserves more credit for the last 20 years, Brady or Belichick. Former Patriots quarterback Drew Bledsoe weighed in on the futures of both. Take a listen.
I do think there's some intrigue probably on both sides of that thing, though, that to see if they can do it without the other guy, you know, for Tommy to see if he can win without Bill, and for Bill to see if he can win without Tommy. I think there's probably some intrigue on both sides of that thing to see, you know, where the, you know, the credit really lies in that situation.
So much talk about who will get the credit. Carson, are you buying Brady and Belichick both want to win on their own separately?
I'm buying that Bill does, but for Brady to be 42 going on 43 and now to go out on his own and try to do it on his
own.
If he was 32, I think you would still see that in Tom, but he knows where his bread is buttered, and it's with Bill Belichick, especially at age 42.
You said something very interesting in the very beginning there, that you think Bill does want to show he can do it on his own. We've never seen Brady without Belichick. We've seen Belichick a number of times without Brady, his whole stint in Cleveland, his first year in New England, and then 2008 when Brady blows out his knee, they win 11 games. That's a good thing. The fact that they had won six, they were 16-0 the year before, puts a little damper on it. And then the Deflategate year, 3-1 with a young Jimmy Garoppolo and an even younger Jacoby Brissett. How much of that do you think feeds into Belichick wanting to say or wanting to show, listen, Brady's the greatest quarterback of all time, but I can do this without him?
I think all of it shows that. You know, like you said, he has not had success without him, and he'll always have that hanging over his head as he goes into retirement. So before Bill does hang him up and decide to walk away from the game, I think he absolutely wants to prove himself without Tom.
You know, I think it's kind of crazy to try to separate the two. I think that Bill Belichick understands one thing, that he hasn't won without Tom. He understands also that he is going to have to play at some point without Tom Brady. Really, when you look at this season, he played without the help of the Tom Brady that we all know and love all season long. He hasn't played well all season long. And so I think if you're Bill Belichick, you're saying, hey, I know I'm going to coach for another 5 to 10 years. Tom Brady's not going to be the Tom Brady that we knew for 5 to 10 years. And if I'm Tom Brady, I'm saying, why would I want to? Why would I want to play without the best coach in the NFL for the last 20 years? Why would I want to go into a situation where there's so many unknowns? If he goes to L.A., there's a bunch of unknowns there in L.A. They have a bunch of talent, but there's still a bunch of unknowns. And I'm telling you right now, at the end of my career, I didn't want to go to San Francisco. There's a whole new thing and a fear when you change the team that you were drafted with, that you've been with your entire career, to go to a different franchise. Would you have wanted that at the end of your career? You played for a few teams, though.
I think when I look at his situation, I compare it back to Brett Favre when he went to Minnesota, and he had a young Adrian Peterson, Percy Harvin. You look at the defensive line they had, the offensive line they had. So, you know, there's an aspect where Brady's going, man, I'm not getting separation on the outside. Julian Edelman's my number one target, a great player. But if he can go to a place maybe like the Chargers, like you're talking about, with Melvin Gordon in the backfield, the receivers they have, the offensive line, you know, I think that will be appealing to him, especially being, you know, a California guy going back to L.A. and surrounding himself with some talent that he hasn't had around him the last handful of years.
So that leads me to this. I was going to ask, who do you think Nick needs more in order to be successful? You would say probably Tom Brady, but if you give him the amount of weapons that he, I know you don't seem to think that he needs all those weapons.
Sure.
Bill Belichick, it seems like he would need more to see where the team is right now in order to be more successful. Which of these two needs more around
him? To be fair to Brady, it's an unfair fight, because as a coach, you just get better every year. You learn more every year. And Belichick's been the best at taking things he learned in the 80s. We talked about in the Super Bowl last year. They took a defensive front from the New York Giants in the late 80s. He was able to implement it in last year's Super Bowl. Your skills don't deteriorate. You get better as long as your mind is still sharp. As a player, after usually the age of about 33, for Brady it appears to have been after the age of about 39, you start to tail off. So at this point in his career, obviously Brady needs more help. It's not, to me, that's not a fair comparison when we're doing the Brady Belichick tail of the tape of, well, how would, if they do split up, one would of course anticipate that Belichick will continue to have more success, because Belichick is not the oldest coach of all time, while Brady's trying to become the oldest quarterback of all time. And so to be fair to Tom, he is going to be 43 years old. So of course he does need some help. I don't think their failure of the offense was entirely about the lack of weapons around him. I think a lot of it was they have a 42-year-old quarterback. But I'll spin that to you and what you were referencing with the Chargers. You were not 42 years old, but when you got to Arizona and you've got arguably the second greatest receiver of all time in Larry Fitzgerald, one of the other things we were talking about during the break was Fitzy going 75 yards to start an overtime of a playoff game against the Packers. How much easier, as you no longer have quite the physical tools you had early in your career in Cincinnati, does it make it for an aging quarterback to have legitimate playmakers on the outside?
it's as important to have those playmakers on the outside as it is to have those guys up front that are really, really good and really physical and give you that extra time. But Tom's at a point in his career where he can't throw the deep digs consistently. He can't throw the deep square outs, the comebacks, all those routes that when you're 28, 29, 32, you can complete those. Get the ball out. That's why he loved having Antonio Brown there. He can throw Antonio Brown a noun route, which is just where the receiver stands up, catches the ball, makes somebody miss, and gets blockers down the field in front of him. And, you know, it's a five-yard pass that ends up going for 15 or 20 yards. So Brady needs those easy completions, those third down completions. He can throw screens and get the ball to elite playmakers to get him more yardage. He doesn't have the same zip on the ball and the same arm strength he has. He needs more guys around
him. When you watched him this year, if he did go to a team like the Chargers that has those weapons, and let's assume they have adequate blockers up front, they had dealt with injuries on the offensive line this year, let's assume they have health, how good do you think he can be at age 43?
I think with Keenan Allen and Mike Williams and those monsters they have outside, two real threats, guys you have to game plan around. And they can add another guy. They've got a great tailback. They can add another guy up front. They get a tight end. You know, at 42, you can still see Tom Brady being one of the better quarterbacks in the league with great talent around him. Without great talent around him, he's not the same Tom Brady we're used to seeing.
Just out of curiosity, what do you think he's going to do next year? What do you think he wants to do?
I think it's going to be really interesting to see how things go down between him and Bill. He's not done. I don't think he's done. He knows he can still play at a high level. There's still accolades and statistics and things for him to chase another Super Bowl. I think at 42 and being in the same place for so long, there's some excitement about going to LA or wherever that team is, that next team may be. There is some excitement. There is some, you know, reason for concern, a new offense, a new place to live, my kids, my, you know, schools, all those things. But when you think about an 8 month or a 9 month season, when it's all said and done, it's worth taking a shot to maybe win one more Super Bowl with the right talent around him.
All right, Carson is here to discuss the FedEx Air and Ground NFL Players of the Year Awards. Tell us about the nominees, Carson.
Yeah, it's a great year. I mean, the quarterbacks, you got Russell Wilson, Lamar Jackson the year he had. Patrick Mahomes is in it again, who won it last year. And my pick, I'd love to see who you like on the ground. I think Derrick Henry's going to win it, but it's been such a fun year to watch these guys. And FedEx is, I'm a former FedEx winner for the Air Player of the Year Award, so it's something that's special and close to my heart. And The voting is currently open. It closes on the 30th, so get your votes in now. You can vote on the NFL Twitter page. You can vote at NFL.com/FedEx, so get your votes in now.
Who do you got for the ground player?
I love what Derrick Henry did towards the end of the year, but, I mean, you can't argue with Christian McCaffrey and the production that he's had. Having over 1,000 yards rushing and 1,000 yards receiving, something that I did in college, it's almost impossible to do in the NFL. You have to get a Christian rookie.
Something told me you were going to love Christian McCaffrey's type of game over the 6'4". 250-pound bruiser. The running back competition, and nobody mentioned Nick Chubb. Nick Chubb at 4:55 p.m. Eastern time on the final weekend of the year was the NFL rushing champion until Derrick Henry ended up stealing it from the second half of that game. We know, I'm not to spoil it, who's going to win the Air Player of the Year. It'd probably be shocking if Lamar doesn't win that title.
Can Lamar win both?
That would be interesting. That would be interesting.
He's got an argument for it.
Here, first things first, we're now joined by Super Bowl champ Greg Jennings.
What
good
up,
morning,
man?
Greg.
Good to see you, brother.
Good to see you guys.
Good to see you, man.
Been a long time.
Looking sharp again.
Yeah, I try.
Every day.
Greg loves the brown. You got a lot of brown looks. They look good on you.
I appreciate it.
Earth tones.
Oh, pardon me.
You have to say it like that. Earth tones.
Oh, pardon me. Professional stylist Brian Westbrook.
You guys all good?
We're good. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're good now.
Here we go. Russell Wilson and the Seahawks will battle Aaron Rodgers.
Like left out of the clothing conversations.
And the Packers, possibly the weather also in Lambeau on Sunday. Our friends at Fox Bet, they have Green Bay as 4-point favorites in this one. Nick, what do you think it would mean for A-Rod's legacy if the Packers get upset in this
game? Bueno. Very bad. Listen, Aaron Rodgers, no one doubts how talented he is. Nobody. I believe he is the most talented, and a lot of people have at this point said it, the most talented thrower of the football ever. Maybe one day Patrick Mahomes can overtake him, but as of right now, it's Rodgers and Marino, to me, are on the top of that mountain. And this might be not his last chance to win a Super Bowl, but his last best chance to win a Super Bowl.
What's the difference?
Well, I think they will be relevant and in it the next few seasons. But he's 36 years old. They're 13-3 with a bye. New England with Brady got 13 byes. The Packers with Rodgers, this is their third.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can just automatically say, well, they'll be right back in this position next year. They haven't won a playoff game since the divisional round of 2016. Last playoff game they were in, they got annihilated by the Falcons, missed the playoffs in 2017 because Rodgers was hurt, missed the playoffs last year for whatever reason they did. The team was just not very good. And so right now you have a team that metrics-wise is not a 13-3 team. They're more like an 11-5, 10-6 team. And Rodgers, last half of the year, has not been great. He's averaging around 200 yards passing the last half of the season. But they ended up with the 2 seed. They ended up having the playoffs, I think, fall great for them, where they don't have to deal with a team just as good, if not better than them, in the New Orleans Saints. Instead, they get a Seattle team that's been getting by on, you know, close games and good fumble luck and things like that throughout the season. And if you don't win this home playoff game to give yourself a chance to avenge the annihilation you suffered during the regular season in the hands of San Francisco, you do wonder, the most talented quarterback I've ever seen, is he going to finish his career with one trip to the Super Bowl? And by the way, zero trips to the Super Bowl since Greg Jennings left, it should be noted. I don't think winning this football game cements his legacy. You know, legacies are not made in the divisional round. But for Rodgers, it could be weakened substantially if they don't make it at least to the conference championship game and probably back to his second Super Bowl.
I agree 100% with everything that you said. When I look at Aaron Rodgers and his legacy, a lot of people are going to look at his individual stats and say, wow, he's put up uber numbers, yep, and he's up there with the conversation of arguably he is the most talented quarterback that we've seen, arguably one of the best to ever play it in a lot of opinions, mine being one of those. But when you look at wins in the postseason, forget just the postseason, at home in the postseason, the inability to get wins in Lambeau with Aaron Rodgers at the helm, it's just not been a good look for him personally. I get it, the team, but he's going to bury and carry all that load when it comes to wins and losses in this time of the season. When you look at quarterback play and you look at where we rank Aaron Rodgers and how highly we see him and talk about him with the heir apparent of Peyton Manning's and Montana's and Tom Brady's as GOAT status.
Sure.
He has to win games like this. And you talk about it being a divisional round, it doesn't matter what round it is. He needs to get to another Super Bowl without Mike McCarthy because, again, one of the reasons why Mike McCarthy is no longer there is because of the relationship that they had and the lack of production that they were able to gain with one another. He has to be able to win without him, and we'll see what it looks like. But they got a great pick or a game against the Seattle Seahawks, a team that's been getting by, like, as you mentioned.
On close games.
When you talk about Aaron Rodgers and his legacy, it comes down to rings. I mean, because there's an upper echelon of quarterbacks, and all of those guys have at least two rings. We talked about it with Drew Brees the other day, with him not having that second ring. You start to wonder, well, you were so good, why don't you have at least two rings? Same thing for Aaron Rodgers. You're one of the best quarterbacks that have ever played the game. Where are the rings at? And so many times in Green Bay, Aaron Rodgers was the reason why they won, and Mike McCarthy was always the reason why they lost. And so he has to be able to prove that I can win divisional games, and I can win potentially another Super Bowl to be discussed in that when you're getting that upper
get
row.
There.
At least get there.
And that's my thing. He has to get there. The rings, that I don't think it all comes down and boils down to just the rings. But getting to the Super Bowl when you've lost in conference championship games the way that they have lost, you got to get back.
Well, when you compare, when we compare Brady and Joe Montana, the first question is who has the most rings, right? Mm-hmm. Kobe, Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. Who has the most rings? When you're talking about your small differences between the greatest of the great, the question comes down to the rings. If Aaron Rodgers is the best quarterback that you've seen, Nick, then you have to ask the question, why hasn't he won more? And again, Mike McCarthy was to blame previously. Now, we're not going to blame Matt LaFleur. We're going to start pointing at Aaron Rodgers. Maybe doing it your way isn't the right way for your team to win.
There's no reason why he shouldn't win this game this weekend. They have a bye. He's
healthy. Oh, I totally
healthy.
Agree with you.
They are at home. I mean, this
and
is.
And Seattle's not a great team.
Right. And they're beat up.
Not a great team. They're banged up. And as great as Russell Wilson is, and I think I was one of the few people who picked Seattle to win that division going into the year. They obviously didn't, but they had 11 wins, which I thought would have been enough to win the division. Seattle is a flawed football team when healthy. We've talked about their game plan issues. We've talked about their inability to trust Russell Wilson to just be brilliant. And just like they win close games, they're not blowing a lot of people out. You know what I mean? And so this is a game that Green Bay absolutely should win. If it was Breeze and the Saints coming in there, you feel a little differently. They would have 2-13-3 teams. You could argue the Saints had the better season. They overcame a 5-week absence of Drew Breeze. There is no argument that the Seattle Seahawks are better than the Green Bay Packers. There is a question, though, right now, and the Packers are my preseason pick to go to the Super Bowl, and Rodgers are my preseason pick to win MVP. But there is a question right now, who's the better quarterback on the field between Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers? And I was looking into this morning. If they lose this game, we are all going to have to acknowledge we're in a different phase of Rodgers' career, because the numbers say we've been there the last 5 years. Put them side by side if we can. There was the 2009-14. It was the greatest statistical stretch of quarterbacking anyone's ever had. Those are average seasons. 36 touchdowns, 8 picks, a 109 rating on average, including he had a 122 rating 1 year. It's unbelievable. The 15-1 year is unbelievable. Since then, those are very good quarterback numbers. But 31 touchdowns to 6 picks, that's a great ratio. But the completion percentage is subpar, and the passer rating is good but not great. That's over the last 5 seasons. That's not a small sample size. One of those years, I understand he was hurt with where Anthony Barr fell on him a couple years ago. But if they don't win this game, you say, okay, what did the Packers do in Rodgers' career when they did get the bye? 1 year, they lose as a 15-1 overwhelming favorite to the New York Giants. The other year with the bye, they have a 2-score lead against Seattle, against Russell Wilson, on the road to go to the Super Bowl, to give us Rodgers, Brady in the Super Bowl, and they melt down from there. And that was the last game Rodgers played in that first column, in that 6-year window. Since that playoff loss, he has been a great quarterback, but not the greatest quarterback. He's got to find a way to channel some of that over this, not just this weekend, but the couple weekends that follow.
And I think that's the key. He has to be what we have seen him be in the past. And I get it. New head coach, new offensive coordinator, new play calling scheme and all
of
that.
Only one reliable weapon.
But in this game, in this moment of the season, in the playoffs, you got to be special. You got to be that star. You got to be the GOAT that everybody believes that you are and capable of being.
I see it a little differently. I think that you got to get the run game going. I think that Aaron Rodgers is great, and we all know what he can do. But I think when you have that run game with Aaron Jones, who's had 5 games over 100 yards, 1 game with 93 yards, pretty close to 100, that makes Aaron Rodgers even more special when you have the threat of the run game.
3 years ago today, Rodgers won his last home playoff game. Came against the Giants. Greg, a little in or out?
Let's do it.
The Giants will reportedly hire Pats special teams coordinator and wide receiver coach Joe Judge to be their new head coach. His first order of business will be developing quarterback Daniel Jones. Brian Westbrook, you in or out on Jones making a leap from year one to year two?
You know, I think Daniel Jones is a smart quarterback, so I'm in. I think that he has ability and he has the help on the offensive side of the ball. They have good receivers on the Giants. They have a good running back. They have to figure out the offensive line thing. Finding the offensive coordinator for Daniel Jones is going to be the most important piece.
I'm in. That's the most important piece. Finding a great connector of making plays work and making him and put him in the best situation to be successful. They have all the pieces. He's been great as of late, having a full season under his belt and a full offseason being the guy. I like it. I'm in.
If I had Daniel Jones stock, which I didn't buy, I would be selling it. I'm out. I don't think a coaching change is usually good for a young quarterback. I don't think going from an offensive-minded head coach in Pat Shurmur to and again, this is nothing about Joe Judge, but to a guy who's not going to be as hands-on with the quarterback is going to be good for him. And until I see Daniel Jones not be the most fumblingest fumbler I've ever seen fumble, I can't be in on him. He's got a giant ball protection problem, so I'm out on that Daniel Jones until I see that get fixed.
All right, moving on. The Carolina Panthers have also found their next head coach, signing Baylor's Matt Rhule to a 7-year deal worth up to $70 million with incentives. Brian, you in or out on Cam Newton being the Panthers' starting quarterback under Rhule?
I'm in, as long as he's healthy, at least for this season here. I think that if you're Matt Rhule, you say, we're going to draft ourselves a quarterback, allow him to kind of fall underneath Cam, try to figure things out in the NFL, and allow him to grow that way, not just to throw him in there as soon as he drafted.
I'm in on Cam. Cam has had arguably some of the most or the most coaching changes since he's entered the league. Offensive coordinators, head coaches. It's been a revolving door, and he's been able to play to a level that this team is competitive. So I'm still in on Cam.
Listen, it's 1 year, it's $20 million, and they have no other options. Kyle Allen's obviously not the answer. Will Greer is not the answer. So they might draft a guy, but because Matt Rhule is going to be able to take the long view of it, and you have the guy who you said was the best running back in football this year, Christian McCaffrey. Mm-hmm. How many more years is he going to be at that level, at that position? Try to take advantage of it with a healthy Cam Newton. I'm not saying you give him a contract extension. Let him play out this year and see how he looks, and then figure out what you're doing at the quarterback position. I am also in.
All right, on to the Patriots now. Drew Bledsoe says Tom Brady and Bill Belichick might have, quote, some intrigue to win on their own and see where the credit really lies. So, Brian, you in or out on Belichick winning Super Bowls, another Super Bowl at least, without Tom Brady?
I'm out. I would be out if the question was, can you win with Tom Brady at this point in his career? The biggest thing, and we mentioned it yesterday, is that you have Patty Mahomes, you have Lamar Jackson, and Deshaun Watson in your conference. And without those guys, then you have a chance. But these are three young quarterbacks that get it done. They're going to win a lot of games here in the future. It's going to be hard for New England just to win, especially without Tom Brady.
I hear you, but I'm in. There's no timetable on Belichick. If he continues to stay at the helm, at the head coach position, he can find a quarterback. They have a good team. He's been known to win. He's created the culture. I'm not out on that. I'm in.
I'm out for a number of reasons. One is the turnover on the staff. You saw it at the University of Alabama, by the way, this year. It finally caught up to them. They have so many coaches leave for other opportunities that you don't have the continuity that an organization or a team like Clemson does, where they keep all their coordinators. Clemson staying at the top of the mountain. Belichick has lost back in back-to-back years defensively. Coordinators just lost his special teams coach. Josh McDaniels at some point.
I don't know if he's going to leave. I think if he keeps him, it's a different story. Right,
well, he might. I think he might not leave this year, but at some point it would look like he's going to be on the way out. If you also lose the quarterback, I agree with even with Tom Brady not going to championship, but at some point you're going to lose the continuity of the coach quarterback combo. No, the Patriot era with or without Brady is over. It ended this past weekend. I am out.
All right. Titans and Ravens squaring off in Baltimore on Saturday. Tennessee head coach Mike Vrabel called Lamar Jackson, quote, the best player in the league who is impossible to tackle. Brian, you in or out on Lamar being the best player in the NFL?
You know, I'm in. I mean, until someone can figure out how to stop Lamar, his ability to throw the ball down the field to wide open receivers and his ability to get on the edge and run the football and just tackle him. Can anybody in the NFL tell me how to tackle this man in open space? It's just hard to do. No one has answered that question quite yet. Until they answer it, he is the best player in the NFL.
I'm in for all the reasons you just said. And his mental approach to the game. When you look at a guy and he talks about, I haven't even unboxed my Heisman Trophy, my focus is winning a Lombardi Trophy, he is laser focused to be that young and this effective. That's hard. That's a great combination in a young guy.
Lamar had the best season. Lamar is sensational. I'm very happy for Lamar. But Brian Westbrook, I'm out. Because why? Who's the best player in the NFL?
Stop
Patty
this.
Mahomes.
Thank you very much.
Is he still the best player in your mind?
Of course he's still the best player in the NFL. He's going to show it over the next month en route to a Super Bowl championship and the trophy that Lamar really wants, the Super Bowl MVP. Listen, this taking nothing away from Lamar Jackson, but Patrick Mahomes is the best player in football. Everybody knows Patrick Mahomes is the best player in football. Even Baltimore knows. He might not be big trust, but he's the best player in football.
It's interesting. This is the first time you're actually mentioning that. So Patrick Mahomes is the guy that you like.
Yeah.
Okay. Cowboys have finally made it official, naming Mike McCarthy their new head coach. Dallas will hold a press conference later today, and then McCarthy gets to go to work. Brian Westbrook, you in or out on the Cowboys being the best team in the NFC East?
I'm out. And the reason is, until they can prove to me that they're not underachievers, then they can't be the best team. There's been too many times that they had the most talent in the NFC East and have found a way to lose the NFC East. And this last year was another example. No matter who your coach is, you still have ballers on that football team, and they couldn't figure out a way to win. And so until they can prove that to me consistently, they can't be the best team in the NFC East.
I'm in. I just don't see why they can't be with a new voice, a new head of household, I like to classify it. these guys are going to be ready to play. They all have something to prove. Mike McCarthy has something to prove. Dak Prescott has something to prove. They've all had individual success. It's time to have team success. I think they get it done.
I'm also out with you, Brian. What, how does it go? Fly,
Eagles. Fly, Eagles. Fly.
Yeah, listen,
you gotta do it like this.
There you go. Well, I'm not going to do the dance, but I think Philly is the best team in the NFC East. Philly won the division despite being annihilated by injuries this year. And your point on there's 1 year in the last decade, 2 years, pardon me, that you could argue the Cowboys didn't underachieve. Dak's first year there and Tony Romo's final healthy year there. Other than that, they've always been talented, found a way to win a game or two fewer than they should have. Philly, I think, will bounce back next season with better health. So I am out on Dallas being the best team in the NFC East.
Welcome back to First Things First. So when the XFL opening weekend kicks off 1 month from today, the new league will feature exciting gameplay innovations. Details online right now at xfl.com/rules. To help us all break it down is XFL Commissioner Oliver Luck. Commish, thanks for joining us.
How are you doing,
sir? Thank you. Nice to be here. Appreciate it.
Well, we are excited just as you are. So tell me, what were the league's goals when you started creating all the rules?
So we wanted to create a package of rules that allows our players and coaches to play fast, right? That up-tempo, fast-paced game. And that comes from the input that we receive from fans. We talked to thousands of fans in focus groups and market research, and they told us they love professional football. It's America's favorite sport, as we all know. But they thought there was too much downtime, too much idle time in a game. Let's pick up the pace a little bit. One of these things, Brian, right? Let's go.
Right.
So we wanted to really put a package of rules together that allows us to play fast and ideally a high-scoring game as well.
So can you take us through that process? Because while involving, I think it was over 6,000 fans is an awesome idea, you're also going to get some insane suggestions that you can't use.
That's right.
So how did you call them and who did you lean on, what type of sources you guys lean on to decide, okay, these are the changes from the what you would call the traditional football rules that we want to implement?
So we brought together a couple of different groups. We had former coaches, guys like Jim Caldwell, John Fox. I wanted to have a quarterback who played both in the NFL and in the CFL, so we brought Doug Flutie in, who gave us some really good insights into some of the things the CFL does that we took a look at. We brought in TV folks. We brought Jim Harbaugh, helped us out, current coaches. We brought in medical professionals because health and safety does play a factor. 10, 15 years ago, it wasn't talked about as much as it is now. So when we were developing our package of rules, we wanted to make sure that we weren't going backwards in terms of health and safety. So we filtered out a lot of the crazy ideas. And there are some crazy ideas out there. And there are a lot of things that, we tested with a bunch of JUCOs and semi-pro leagues. We actually had guys in full pads going through, kickoffs and punts and you name it, all the different timing aspects. And we wanted to make sure that what we thought looked good on the whiteboard, on the chalkboard, actually looked good on film and was teachable to players, because that's important as well. We've got about a dozen or so innovations, but we don't want a player to be thinking too much, oh, what league am I in, when he's back there kind of fielding a punt, right? Because you got other things to worry about. So I think it came together fairly well with all that. But the input we received from guys like Caldwell and Fox and Flutie and others really was invaluable for us.
One of the most intriguing rules that you guys have come up with is the double forward pass on one play. How did you guys come up with that, and how will that impact the way the game is being played right now at this point?
So if you think about it, quarterbacks are in the shotgun 60, 70% of the time nowadays, right? So they're 5, 6 yards back. You can't really throw the double forward. You can't throw that trick play if you're throwing the ball backward already 5 yards from the line of scrimmage, and you got to have your wide out, 6 yards back. You're giving the play away, basically. So we said, let's change that rule. As long as the ball doesn't cross the line of scrimmage, let's allow the quarterback to have a quick pass to the side and then allow that receiver to throw it, or the running back on the jet sweep. So we think that it's a big play. We think fans like to see it. We think it's exciting. I loved it. And we've got a bunch of players in our league, guys like B.J. Daniels, former quarterback at South Florida. who's with the Seattle Dragons right now, and he probably won't be the starter, but he can play, right? So you put a quarterback like that or a player like that out on on the slot or in the wideout, I think that play becomes all of a sudden very valuable. And it's an exciting, fun play, often a scoring play. So we think that'll loosen things up a little bit.
The other interesting rule, receivers just have to have 1 foot inbounds for a catch. How'd you guys come up with that?
That's the college rule, obviously. Yep. And we came up with that because it's easier, quite honestly, to officiate. And one thing, Brian, you might think about this.
That's interesting.
Yeah, well, we want to make sure that our game is as simple as possible to officiate, to remove as much sort of doubt as can be. But one of the things that came out as we were talking to receivers is the 1 foot inbounds rule is actually safer because it allows you to kind of do that football fall and roll your shoulder. And if you're dragging both feet, you're pretty much exposed. So we realize, hey, this is actually a little bit safer and we think it's easier to officiate. Why not? Let's do it. We've seen it 1,000 times on a Saturday afternoon with college ball. So that we didn't really have to test too much that particular rule.
From reading the rules on the website, xfl.com/rules, there aren't a ton of things on there that football fans are going to be like, I don't know. I think the double forward pass is the biggest change, aside from the overtime. The shootout format in overtime is a change, and I think one people are going to see and say, man, I wish other leagues would implement it. If people haven't checked out the rules website yet, can you explain to the audience what that is?
So the overtime rule basically is this. You know, we wanted to come up with a solution where the players that decided the 60 minutes of regulation were the ones that decided overtime. Both teams, right? The offense and defense of both teams. So think about a hockey shootout or a soccer shootout. You've got offensive team A, defensive team B, and then the offensive team B and the defensive team A, and they're running plays, right? Alternate plays from the 5-yard line, play from scrimmage. Whoever scores the most wins the game. We solved for having both offenses and defenses out there, which I think is sort of an issue of fundamental fairness. And we also needed to solve for getting overtime done relatively quickly. Our game is about a 2-hour, 45-minute game with our 25-second clock. So we wanted to make sure we could get an overtime done in 8 to 9 minutes and not, sort of go outside that window of 3 hours.
And it removes kickers from the overtime.
It does remove kickers from the overtime.
Did you consider removing kickers from the league entirely?
Yes. Yes, we did until my butt. We tried. No, we still have field goals and we have kickoffs. So we still got the kicker in the game. We're not entirely taking the foot out of football. Yeah.
The other big rule change, just real quick, and I thought this was important, the extra point. You have the ability to get, 2 points or?
Or 3 points.
We've got
three options. You score a touchdown at 6 points, very traditional, and then you got a 1-point option, which is a play from scrimmage from the 2-yard line, a 2-point option, play from scrimmage from the 5-yard line, and a 3-point option, which is a play from scrimmage from the 10. So you can have a 9-point touchdown. We think it can turn a 2-score game into a 1-score game and allow teams to come back, and we think there's great strategy in deciding, head coach, do I go for 1, 2, or 3, right? And we love to second-guess coaches. We love to second guess as fans, so this will be a lot of second guessing.
It's exciting. It's going to be fast. It's obviously going to be safer. There's some tweaks to the rules, which I think will be a lot of fun for both the fans at home to watch, the players to play, and then obviously the officials to officiate. Commissioner, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. We're excited for this.
Thank you, Nick. Brian,
always a
pleasure.
Anyway, for opening weekend, 1 month from today. Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern.